Admiral Rice, recording reminiscences and recollections of Frank Knox as a background for Commander Buell and his projected book on Admiral King. Frank Knox, a lifelong Republican and the vice presidential running mate of Alf Landon in 1936, and publisher of the Chicago Daily News, accepted President Roosevelt's invitation to join the cabinet as Secretary of the Navy in the summer of 1940. At about the same time, another outstanding Republican, Colonel Harry Stimson, became Secretary of War. I first met Mr. Knox on the day of his appearance before the Senate committee in connection with his confirmation as SecNav. After the hearings, he came to the little Mathis houseboat Sequoia to look it over. After I had conducted him on a tour of the yacht, he said to me, "Could I live on board?" My answer, of course, was that it was his to use as he saw fit, but I thought the Sequoia quite livable. We were staffed to take care of him. We had a fine crew, an excellent steward, and several good cooks. We had one fairly large stateroom and three smaller ones. His response was typical: "I'll move aboard tomorrow." Thus began a new chapter in the life of the Sequoia, which had served as the presidential yacht until the Secret Service simply couldn't stomach the Sequoia's wooden hull and gasoline engines, coupled with FDR's paralysis. A Coast Guard cutter was procured for the president, suitably equipped and renamed the Potomac. The Sequoia, with new diesel engines, became the Secretary of the Navy's yacht. The two ships moored at the same pier in the Washington Navy Yard. That's the old gun factory. Generally, the Sequoia had been used for short trips down the Potomac River on special occasions. Now had come an opportunity for the ship and her crew to do something really constructive, to provide for a busy secretary, a comfortable base, which could, if properly organized and handled, contribute significantly to the Secretary's comfort, his efficiency and effectiveness in those trying times. Because Mrs. Knox suffered acutely from asthma, she could not undertake the Washington summer climate and the social pressures of the cabinet wife. Very quickly, our routine developed, worked out between me and Mr. John O'Keefe, business manager of the Chicago Daily News, who came to Washington as Colonel Knox's confidential secretary and lived on board the Sequoia for a time also. Our days ran pretty much as follows, except when the SecNav was out of town or on the weekends, when he usually managed to fly to Manchester, New Hampshire, to spend the time at his home. At the end of his office day, the secretary came on board. We almost always had dinner guests. John O'Keefe kept me posted on last-minute changes by telephone from the office. Underway down the Potomac, dinner shortly after we cleared the yard. Our guests included cabinet officers and their wives, justices of the Supreme Court, ambassadors, journalist friends of Colonel Knox, high-ranking officers of the Navy, of course, in all a most interesting parade of people. Characteristically, Colonel Knox insisted that I dine with him and his guests, a touchy matter with me at times because I was the only officer on board and the flat-bottomed Sequoia with a large mahogany and plate glass top hamper skated around alarmingly in any wind. I had an excellent chief quartermaster, however, and a fine crew, so I usually managed to stay at the table, albeit sometimes too preoccupied to make inspired conversation. Depending upon the weather and the plans of our guests, we returned to the yard at about 10 or 11 in the evening to land the guests who were not spending the night on board. Having cleared the guests, we got underway downriver to a quiet anchorage off Marshall Hall, a little south of Mount Vernon. The secretary had an undisturbed, quiet night, excellent sleeping. In the morning, underway at about 6:30 to Fort Washington, to moor there while Mr. Knox and I had a brisk half-hour walk every morning. then underway for the Navy Yard, breakfasting en route. When we moored at the yard, the secretary's car was there waiting. West, the chauffeur, brought the morning paper on board, which the secretary looked over before leaving the office. Infrequently, Mr. Knox came to the Sequoia for luncheon with special guests. Later on, as his habits and needs took form, we set up and ran a small mess in his office. Practically all of Colonel Knox's entertaining was business. That is, the Navy's business. I think the only occasion on which he asked me not to come in to dinner was the evening when Lord Lothian, the British ambassador, came alone. Later that evening, when John O'Keefe and the secretary worked out the record in the little office we had off the wardroom, I knew that the destroyer deal, the exchange of 50 destroyers for the use of Bermuda as a base, had been worked out that evening. Frequent guests of a more personal nature were John Sullivan, then Assistant Secretary of the Treasury, later SecNav, for whom Colonel Knox had an avuncular affection. He was a neighbor in New Hampshire and the son of an old friend. Ralph Bard of Chicago, who later became Assistant SecNav and then SecNav. Mr. Raleigh Warner, Chairman of the Pure Oil Company, Chicago friend. James Forrestal, then a member of the White House staff, with what the president liked to call a passion for anonymity. Forrestal was a frequent guest and usually spent the night with us. I remember several evenings after all the other guests had left and we had anchored off Marshall Hall in the Potomac. We sat around the table over midnight fruit. The secretary enjoyed reminiscing about his youthful days in the Rough Riders, and his admiration for Teddy Roosevelt was notable. He found a strong contrast between the Army and the Navy, much to the Navy's credit, I might say. His World War I experience as a captain of the ammunition supply train transporting shells to the front by horse was a favorite recollection. He enjoyed describing the atmosphere of William Randolph Hearst's San Simeon in the days when he worked for the Hearst papers. Frank Knox came to Washington in the spirit of the Minutemen to Concord. His motivation was the desire to serve his country, his goal to assist in saving our country and the West from the threat of Hitler and the Japanese. His value to the Navy and to the country was great, in my opinion. He had no ulterior motives, no complex ambitions. He was perfectly straightforward, honest, dedicated. To people like me, he was friendly, most considerate. I remember thinking often what a shame it was that he and Annie, Mrs. Knox, had no children. He would have made a fine father. He was, above all, decisive. Though fully exposed to life as it is, having been a newspaper man all his life, he did not relish off-color stories or body language. He was not sanctimonious, but he had an instinctive dignity without prudery. His hero was Teddy Roosevelt, a small statue of whom was always on his desk. Knox now and then characterized something as bully. The only time I remember his using somewhat vulgar language is this. He had been invited to spend the weekend with FDR on board the Potomac. It turned out to be a weekend of solid rain, which the Potomac spent at anchor in the lower Chesapeake Bay area. When the Potomac returned and moored near the Sequoia on Sunday night, I asked the secretary how he'd enjoyed his weekend with his Democratic boss. He said, "Bob, do you know what we did all for 2 days? We thought up names for aircraft carriers." FDR is all man from the asshole up. To illustrate Colonel Knox's thoughtfulness and consideration, I had been married a year before, during Secretary Edison's time, when the Sequoia routine was quite different. Mr. Knox made sure that my wife was invited to dinner often, since he was acutely aware of our separation, occasioned by the night routine and the daily chores. Finally, at breakfast one morning, he said, "Bob, I want you to see more of Eunice, and I think I've got the solution." I'm going to have this Chief of Naval Operations get an alternate captain for the Sequoia. Then you and the other captain can take turns. Naturally, I declined such a solution and told the secretary in what must have seemed to him condescending terms. I told him that there can be only one captain. Two cannot command. And if there were to be two captains, I didn't want to be one of them. In the spring of 1941, Mr. Knox decided to go to Palm Beach in the Sequoia, taking Mrs. Knox and her sister, Miss Reed. This would provide a rest for him and a convenient method of looking over the new Naval Air Station just being cleared for construction at Jacksonville and to inspect the Charleston, South Carolina naval activities. The plan was for me to take Mrs. Knox and Miss Reed down through the intracoastal waterway to Charleston, where the Secretary and Captain Dale would join up for the remainder of the trip south. This trip provided several examples of Colonel Knox's character. First of all, he urged my wife to go along. She, being employed as an intelligence analyst in naval intelligence, couldn't do the trip, but she did, thanks to his thoughtfulness, come to Charleston by train, joined us, and made the return trip in the Sequoia to Washington. Colonel Knox's thoughtfulness and affection for not only Mrs. Knox, but also for his sister-in-law was always evident. There was always time for them and for their interests, far removed sometimes from the affairs of state and the Navy, which occupied his mind. On this cruise, there occurred an incident which illustrates the breadth and generosity of a big man. Here it is. One afternoon, the secretary made a golfing date for some town up ahead, a game to be played in the town I don't remember now. In any case, after we had moored for the night at New Smyrna, I told the secretary that I'd have him at the new spot for golf at 3 p.m. the next day. At about an hour before sunrise the next morning, we got underway from the mooring at New Smyrna. It was necessary to make a sharp, almost 180-degree turn down the waterway at a time when there was a little light and when a strong current made from the sea through the inlet. As we made the turn, getting into a strong current on our stern, we blew for the drawbridge ahead of us to open. Nothing happened. With the current, it was necessary to keep power on to retain rudder control. We blew again. Nothing happened. As I was considering the wisdom and the hazards of anchoring there in the fairway, I saw a seemingly decrepit individual walking with agonizing deliberation from a little hut to the drawbridge. Presently he, or she, began turning a hand wheel, and the rickety wooden bridge started reluctantly to swing. It was Nip and Tuck, as we maintained our heading in the strong flood tide. But we didn't quite make it. With the bridge partially open, the Sequoia struck it on our starboard side, bounced off, bounced through the narrow opening, and ran aground. What a predicament. The Secretary of the Navy aground in the mud, his flagship with a hole in her side just above the waterline. And what a disgrace for her captain. In the half-light of dawn, I stood on the guardrail and through the engine room window, queried the chief machinist mate. "No, we're not taking any water here," he said. I could quite plainly see the hole through the wooden side. At that moment, I heard Colonel Knox's voice close behind me. There he was in his bathroom. "Shall I get the ladies up? Up here? Can we get them off the ship? What's our damage? What should we do?" I explained that we had a small break in the hull, that we were aground temporarily, but that we could handle it. He went below then. We got clear of the bottom and nailed canvas, sheet lead, and wooden slats over the hole, and shortly we were on our way, crestfallen but functioning, to keep the golfing date. Somewhat later, a steward approached me on the bridge, saying the secretary wanted to know when I was coming in to breakfast. Most reluctantly, I went into the salon, where Colonel Knox, now fully dressed, was eating his breakfast. I sat down, heard from him the effect of our collision on his and Mrs. Knox's stateroom, and reported the measures taken to get to our afternoon rendezvous. The secretary said, "What happened? What caused it?" I replied that I had erred in judgment in leaving our berth under conditions of light and tide, which rather invited trouble if everything didn't just click right. The secretary looked at me and said, "What was Ty Cobb's batting average?" I made a guess in the high 300s, to which he replied, "Your batting average is pretty darn good. Nobody's perfect." That, as far as Colonel Knox was concerned, was that. Later, I had reason to think that Captain Dale would have disagreed with such a dismissal of the event, but that was the last of it. I realize that my recollections do not specifically tie Secretary Knox to Admiral King and to the selection of the latter as the future Commander-in-Chief. I do not remember specifically discussing King with Knox. Early in my association with Colonel Knox, he frequently asked, "What do you think of Admiral so-and-so?" I would reply that I had not served directly under Admiral so-and-so, and I thus had simply no basis for an opinion of him. After several of these exchanges, and as he became familiar with the Navy, he stopped asking me such questions. I'm sure, however, that if we did discuss King, I would have answered in the terms I've already expressed to you in my letters. Colonel Knox knew that I had been invited by Admiral King to be his aide, and that I had declined in favor of the submarine command I thought I could get. At the end of the war, I became, as a captain, administrative aide to Admiral Denfeld, Chief of Naval Personnel. Denfeld took command of the parade in honor of the late Secretary Knox for his burial at Arlington. I was given command of the Guard of Honor, a seaman guard furnished by the receiving station at the Washington Navy Yard. We formed on Constitution Avenue in front of the old Navy Department building for the sad march across the Memorial Bridge to the cemetery. I confess that I was dismayed to behold the far-from-smart command that I had inherited, and wished for a moment that the Navy could afford the kind of trained honor guard the Army maintained for such ceremonies. As we waited there for the march, Jim Forrestal, then SecNav, came up to me and said, "This is a sad day." He taught me to respect naval officers.